Creative Male Aging, a radio and internet project in which we explore and challenge many of the conventions around aging and look particularly at new options for today's older men. I'm Tony Ryan. Welcome to the program.
And so it would be an opportune time for a partner to say to the man, look, you know, now's a good time to go and have a chat to the GP and look at your health generally. And as part of that, considering the role of testosterone would be relevant, but certainly by no means the top of the list, but a sensible part of a discussion.
In the program today, we'll hear from three medical specialists talking about some key concerns for many men around prostate cancer, erectile dysfunction, and testosterone replacement therapy. We've given much thought to the content of this program, and while some of the content may not be for younger ears, the production team believes that this information is so very important for men of all ages and also for their partners. We begin with Melbourne-based urologist Mr. Jeremy Grummett on the important function of the prostate.
The prostate is a gland that sits deep in the male pelvis, okay, so it's only in men. And it actually does have a function, which a lot of people don't know about. Its function is to produce seminal fluid. So when a man ejaculates, the vast majority of fluid that comes out is actually produced by the prostate. A small fraction, of course, is sperm itself, which has come from the testicles, and that comes up and joins the prostate as it's being ejaculated, and the prostatic fluid allows the sperm, I guess, to swim. Create a pregnancy, but also provides them with a bit of nourishment as well.
To my way of thinking, we only hear about the prostate in a rather negative context.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I suppose because nobody really takes heed or even knows or is aware of the prostate's function, and therefore, once that's out of the way, the only other things that can happen to it are bad, really. So, of course, your main conditions or diseases that affect the prostate, number one on everyone's minds, of course, is prostate cancer. But still, very importantly, are the benign diseases of the prostate. So benign enlargement, which is also extremely common, and inflammation or infection of the prostate, which is called prostatitis.
What would be one of the early symptoms that something might be wrong in that area?
Well, the symptoms, if you think about it anatomically, the symptoms relate to where the prostate sits. Now, as I mentioned, it's deep in the pelvis, but more specifically, it is directly below the bladder, at the outlet of the bladder, and it actually surrounds the first part of the urethra, and the urethra is the tube through which urine flows when we urinate. So you can imagine that if something affects the prostate, it's going to affect the waterworks. And if the prostate enlarges, it can constrict the outflow, and that can cause difficulty in passing urine. And at its most extreme, it can actually block off the bladder outlet altogether. And that's something that we call acute urinary retention. And that can be an extremely painful condition where men can't even void at all. And so they need to have an urgent placement of a catheter. But generally, the more common lower-grade symptoms are, as I mentioned, reduced flow, more frequent urination, and that's because the bladder may not be emptying properly each time. Getting up at night multiple times is another one. And one of the most bothersome symptoms is, in fact, a sense of urinary urgency, so that desire that when you've got to go, you've got to go.
When a man suspects that something's wrong in that area, what should be his first step?
I think if the man thinks there's anything wrong in that area, then the first step is to approach his general practitioner. If something is very fleeting, if it was only symptoms that were lasting for a couple of days, then that might settle of its own accord, in which case you wouldn't need to. But generally speaking, if it's an ongoing symptom that's recently developed, first port of call is the GP.
What then is your role as a urologist?
Well, it's a good question because obviously we only see the pointy end of this population of people with symptoms. The vast majority of men are handled very well by the general practitioners. But when the GP is worried, for example, about prostate cancer as being a potential diagnosis, or the symptoms, the urinary symptoms that the man might present with are severe, then the GP will refer to us as urologists. And so what we'll then do is, being specialised in that area, is either, or well, make a fresh assessment, order the appropriate tests, and if treatment is required, we'll institute that. And as urologists, we're surgeons. And so if it's surgical treatment that's required, we also perform that.
That's a big step for a man to take, to actually head towards surgery. What are the options?
Well, surgical treatment obviously can apply to both prostate cancer but also benign enlargement. So I guess we have to split it up into those two very different conditions. When we talk about prostate cancer, the typical surgical treatment is what's called a radical prostatectomy, and that's where we remove the entire prostate because it contains what we feel, to the best of our knowledge, is aggressive cancer that has the potential to spread and possibly even cause death of that patient. So radical prostatectomy can be done in a variety of different ways, but the end result is always entire removal of the prostate. But we have the traditional open approach, and we also have minimally invasive methods of performing the procedure, which may or may not include the assistance of a robot.
What kind of advice do you give to a man who's in that situation in terms of the longer-term effects?
So if you've got a guy who does have localised prostate cancer, in other words, there's no evidence of spread outside the prostate, and he's opted for a surgery, then regardless of whether the approach is open or robotic prostatectomy, which are the two most commonly performed, then it's really important that he's aware of the potential for long-term side effects. There's nothing worse than giving false expectations to patients who will only then likely be disappointed and will have potentially regret that they had actually undergone that particular treatment. So the two big things that they need to know about are the potential for erectile dysfunction, and the second one is urinary incontinence. These are the two most common longer-term side effects of this surgery. Now, thankfully, with urinary incontinence, which is obviously could potentially be a devastating side effect, that is uncommon. However, erectile dysfunction is far more common, and if your patient is sexually active and that sexual activity constitutes a significant or constitutes a really important part of their quality of life, then they need to be fully aware that the chance of them having the same sort of erectile function that they're used to is actually pretty small. And in some men, they'll have no erectile function whatsoever after the procedure. And that's even when we perform what we call a bilateral nerve-sparing procedure. So again, back to the anatomy, there are nerves which run right alongside the prostate and they go on to the penis to supply it with erectile function. Even when we give our very best efforts to preserve those nerves, even in those guys, because the nerves are so fragile and they can be damaged, those men still have a significant risk of erectile dysfunction as well. So men need to be well aware of that potential outcome, but just as importantly, they need to be aware of the highly effective treatments of those side effects. And I think this is where we as urologists can probably do a bit better in terms of what we tell our patients who are undergoing radical prostatectomy of not only the side effects, but how we actually have very good treatments for them.
Today in Creative Male Aging, we're looking at some key health concerns for men. Urologist Mr. Jeremy Grummet mentioned erectile dysfunction, a situation that can and does cause significant concerns for many men. Here's endocrinologist Associate Professor Douglas Lording in Melbourne.
Erectile dysfunction is the inability to achieve and to maintain an erection sufficient for normal sexual activity. There is an increasing prevalence of erectile dysfunction per decade from about the age of 20 or 30 onwards, so that older men in their 70s and 80s, perhaps only 20% or so are getting erections, and that's an accumulation of a variety of illnesses, of medications, general ill health, adverse life experiences, and ageing.
When men become aware that this could be a problem, what should be the next step?
It's a really important question. When men get erectile dysfunction, the key thing from our medical point of view is to make sure that they have a proper medical assessment so that all of the various associated conditions can be checked. Erectile dysfunction is a really important symptom, often associated with either mental health issues like depression or a number of physical conditions, particularly those that link with heart disease. Men with erectile dysfunction may have previously undiagnosed diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, and indeed they may already have silent or undiagnosed coronary artery disease. So it's really important that men with erectile dysfunction have a checkup whether or not they want to be sexually active. Of course, if men value their ability to have sexual intercourse, then they should also see their doctor early on before that change in sexual function starts to change the relationship. That's really important.
In your experience, do men find it difficult to make that first step to going to see their GP?
Men do find it difficult to raise sexual matters with their GP, particularly if the GP is sort of the friend GP, been seeing them for many years for all the family problems. They are embarrassed, and we know this from surveys that have been done about men who bypass healthcare providers to get help. We know that many men go to the internet and purchase tablets for promoting erections off the internet, or they go to these commercial, if you like, clinics that don't practice good medicine and can often have consultations on the phone. So it is an issue, and we try in our community health education programs to encourage men to understand that this is an important symptom, but we're also trying to encourage doctors to make sure that their practices are sexual health friendly and that people feel that they can talk to them about it. In fact, we're always teaching doctors to ask about sexual function now because it's such an important symptom.
It can, I guess, be embarrassing for the man, but I guess it can be embarrassing for the doctor.
Of course it can. Doctors, a lot of them are female, don't find it easy to talk to men about sexual problems. On the other side of that, a lot of men find it much easier to talk to women about it than the male doctors. Some have different ethnic and religious backgrounds, and so there's a real issue there, and the practice as a whole should, however, try and embrace this and at least have one or two of the members of the practice, if it's a group practice, that other members could resort to help patients if they're in need. But, you know, there is a huge barrier, and it also takes time. Once you ask that sexual function question, you're not having a six-minute quick consultation anymore.
What's the role of the partner in this context?
At the time when erectile dysfunction is developing, the attitude of the partner can have a very big influence on how things will work out. The critical, analytical partner will place a lot of pressure on the male person here, whereas the more sympathetic and helpful partner may in fact help overcome the problem. We find many, many women are the ones that encourage men to seek help and really take a leading role in how to manage the erectile dysfunction.
So what happens after it's raised with the GP? I guess there are some tests.
Yes, well, the GP will need to ask some questions to clearly define what the nature of the problem is and the general health implications, do some appropriate tests. If it's not already known, check for diabetes, check for high blood pressure. There are other medical conditions that would be checked for depending on what the history and examination shows. And then there'd be a discussion about how to approach this to restore sexual function.
I'd imagine that an important part of all of this would be good health in the first place, like avoiding smoking, avoiding drugs and so on.
Yeah, I think one can help preserve one's sexual function by adopting a healthy lifestyle, physical activity, good weight, no cigarettes, reduced alcohol, healthy diet, healthy attitude to life, stress reduction, all those things that we find so hard to grasp.
Dr. Lording, as men do experience erectile dysfunction, what does this do to their image of themselves and their image as men?
Well, I think it's very common for men who develop erectile dysfunction to have great difficulties accepting this change of their male behaviour. To most men, the ability to have sex, have an erection and have sex is really a key part of their masculinity. A lot of men try and hide it when this is evolving, try and work around it, and maybe start to avoid sexual activity with their partner. This will create a significant change in the relationship, and a partner becomes concerned and suspicious and worried. And that then conveys further issues for the man, who often, you know, finds their self-esteem diminished, becoming more angry, maybe the mood diminishing. Depression is a common consequence of erectile dysfunction. It can have really significant implications. So although there might be a physical cause for the erection problem, it's always important for us as doctors to remember that there'll often be some mental health issues secondary to it. But of course, mental health issues can also cause erectile dysfunction. So the relationship with depression is very important. Depression causes erectile dysfunction. Antidepressant medications often take away sex drive, delay orgasm, and in fact can cause erectile dysfunction in their own right, some of them. And of course, treating the depression might improve erectile dysfunction. It's a really difficult area to manage, the combination of erectile dysfunction and depression. And often the best way, if antidepressants are going to be used, is to combine that with treatment of the erectile dysfunction with PDE5 inhibitors. The good thing is, in this day and age, most men who have erectile dysfunction and who want to return to having normal sexual activity, we can achieve that, usually with oral medication, but if not, there are other options.
Endocrinologist Associate Professor Douglas Lording. On the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Creative Male Ageing, a series of 12 programs in which we challenge the stereotypes and explore new options for today's older men. Earlier in the program, mention was made of testosterone replacement therapy. Associate Professor Carolyn Allen has a special interest in the role of androgens in the ageing male. What is testosterone?
Testosterone is a hormone, and it's effectively the hormone that makes men men. Women have estrogen and men have testosterone, and it's the hormone that's important when they go through puberty, and we see changes as men become adult males in terms of their height, their muscle, deepening of their voice, and also helps with their sexual function.
Do levels of testosterone change over time?
That's something that we're really still understanding. Unlike women, whereby all women go through menopause at approximately the age of 50, men's hormone levels change in a much more subtle fashion. Some men will have a gradual decline in their testosterone level as they age, say, between 20 and 80, but other men in their 70s and 80s may well still have testosterone levels that are similar to those for young men. And the good news for men is that they can do something about this, because we know that if men maintain good health as they age, and in particular don't become obese, then they're just as likely to have a good testosterone level as a man in his 30s or 40s.
Why is a good testosterone level important?
We know that testosterone levels are important for general well-being, for quality of life, for energy levels, for vigour, for maintaining a good mood, for concentration. We know they're important for sexual health, in particular for sex drive or libido. When it comes to actually erections, we know that nerve and blood vessel function are probably the most important, but testosterone still plays a role. We know it's important in maintaining muscle strength, and particularly as men age into their 70s and 80s and frailty becomes an issue, testosterone and its role in muscle is really important. It's also important for bone health and preventing osteoporosis. We often think of osteoporosis as something that's associated with women. Men are also at risk of osteoporosis if they have low testosterone levels.
Carolyn, what should happen when a man does have low testosterone?
So if a man is told that he has a low testosterone level, the first thing that we want to do is make sure that it's a consistent low testosterone level. For example, if a man was unwell, he had a very nasty flu, that might be enough to just drop his testosterone level for a little while, but then it returns itself to normal. So the first thing we do is often repeat the tests, examine the man, look to see if there are any features, what do his testes look like, are there any clues in his history that he might have had a reason to have a low testosterone level. Did he have an infection? Did he have any troubles going through puberty? Were there troubles with fertility? All of those features. Because once we decide that a man has a clearly low testosterone, we assume that that is going to be a lifelong condition. And therefore, we would replace his testosterone and he would remain on treatment lifelong. There are lots of options for treatment that include tablets, patches, gels, injections, and it's a matter of a man discussing with his doctor which is the right form of treatment for him. Once he's on that treatment, we check levels to make sure that we're not giving him too much, but all the same that we're actually adequately treating him, and then we monitor things such as we look to see if he's got osteoporosis or is at risk, and we monitor that with a special x-ray called a bone density study or a DEXA scan. We monitor a man's prostate, a very controversial area, and of course if there were any concerns we would involve a urologist, but we need to make sure that the man doesn't have any prostate problems when we start. So perhaps sometimes it's the partner that might notice that the man isn't his usual self. Now of course the focus of this discussion is testosterone, but there are many other things that contribute. And so it would be an opportune time for a partner to say to the man, look, you know, now's a good time to go and have a chat to the GP and look at your health generally. And as part of that, considering the role of testosterone would be relevant, but, you know, certainly by no means the top of the list, but a sensible part of a discussion. The good news, however, for men is that unlike women, whereby we will all go through menopause and we have no choice, a man may actually have some say in what his testosterone level is. It sounds very bland and boring and sometimes very difficult to achieve, but being healthy, exercising regularly, keeping your weight down, ensuring that your health is good, treating your cholesterol if you've got it, keeping your blood glucose levels under check if you've got diabetes, better still preventing diabetes if we can, gives a man a very good chance of actually maintaining a normal testosterone level. And just recently, some work that we were privileged to be a part of that our colleagues in Sydney at the ANZAC Institute published actually showed very nicely that in men who came along and volunteered to help us out by giving some blood samples because they thought they were in really good health as they got older, had testosterone levels that were no different to men in their 30s. And that is the good news for men. Be out there, be proactive about your health, and you've got every chance of maintaining a good serum testosterone level.
In this day and age, many of us rely on the internet for information. And I'm wondering, given that you mentioned the science earlier, what's the role of the internet and what are maybe some of the dangers that a man might come across?
The internet is fantastic in that it makes information accessible in ways that it never was. And I think it's fantastic when I see men in my clinics who come along and say, I've read this or I've read that. It's a great starting point for a conversation. And there are some fantastic websites out there. Of course, as an advisor to Andrology Australia, I would send everybody to the Andrology Australia website. However, of course, people can say whatever they like. And there is a sense out there that testosterone may be a panacea or the fountain of youth. And many men have had a very good experience, and that's wonderful for them. But until we have the trials, we don't know whether it's truly the testosterone that is of benefit in these men. And one would caution against taking one person's story on the internet and saying that this would be representative of good treatment for everybody. And there is, in fact, quite a degree of consensus between the Europeans, the English, and the Americans. What would differ would be the types of treatments that are available and how accessible those treatments are. For example, in Australia, we have quite strict guidelines to advise us as to who it would be appropriate to treat and what treatments are available for which men on our PBS so that your script is partly reimbursed. It's very different, and there are different systems, particularly in the United States, whereby it's somewhat more dependent on the insurance companies. So that aspect, the treatment aspect about what treatments and who's eligible, and even the names of the treatments, same drugs but different names overseas. But the basic information from the reputable societies, such as we have the US Endocrine Society, for example, would be giving reasonably consistent advice.
Associate Professor Carolyn Allen. Here's a final word from urologist Mr. Jeremy Grummett.
I guess on the flip side, we get to sometimes give some really pleasant news, and that might be in the form of a biopsy that's shown no cancer, or it might be in the form of a successful treatment where they have had cancer but it's been a curative treatment and there's no remaining disease. And it's an absolute pleasure, I guess, to see those guys leave the consultation rooms with a big smile on their face, and they'll often come in with their partners, which I think is very important as well, by the way, as another set of ears. And the number of times I've heard men say, I think we better crack open a bottle of champagne tonight. And so that's really lovely. But they'll particularly say that if they have come in with their partner, so that they can share in that relief, I guess, and joy. Another thing I think men often do in the setting when they leave a urology consultation rooms is they'll often say, well, I'm going to go out there and tell my mates. And that's a really encouraging thing to hear as well, because you can, I think with prostate health, but also just anything urological really, you know, the more the news gets spread, the better off patients are going to be, because they're more likely, I think, to access health services earlier and hopefully prevent, bad outcomes.
Today in Creative Male Ageing, we've been talking about some key concerns for many men around prostate cancer, erectile dysfunction, and testosterone replacement therapy. We've heard from urologist Mr. Jeremy Grummett and from endocrinologists Associate Professor Douglas Lording and Associate Professor Carolyn Allen. All three are consultants with Andrology Australia, the Centre for Male Reproductive Health based in Monash University in Melbourne. So a special word of thanks to Andrology Australia for their assistance with this program. You may wish to visit their website, andrologyaustralia.org. That's andrologyaustralia.org. The project consultant for the Creative Male Ageing Project is South Australian-based psychotherapist, author and educator, Dr. John Ashfield. This Aspects of Ageing project was made possible with assistance from the Office for the Ageing, Department of Health, the Government of South Australia. From PBAFM in Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan. Till next time, go well.